The mystery of mysteries to Francie was the Chinaman's one-windowed store. The Chinaman wore his pigtail wound around his head. That was so he could go back to China if he wanted to, Mama said. Once he cut it off, they would never let him return. He shuffled back and forth silently in his black felt slippers and listened patiently to instructions about shirts. When Francie spoke to him, he folded his hands in the wide sleeves of his nankeen shirt coat and kept his eyes on the ground. She thought that he was wise and contemplative and listened with all his heart. But he understood nothing of what she said, having little English. All he knew was tiki and shirty. When Francie brought her father's soiled shirt there, he whisked it under the counter, took a square of mysteriously textured paper, dipped a thin brush into a pot of India ink, made a few strokes, and gave her this magic document in exchange for a common dirty shirt. It seemed a wonderful barter. The inside of the store had a clean, warm, but fragile scent, like odorless flowers in a hot room. He did the washing in some mysterious recess, and it must have been in the dead of night, because all day, from 7 in the morning until 10 at night, he stood in the store at his clean ironing board, pushing a heavy black iron back and forth. The iron must have had a tiny gasoline arrangement inside it to keep it hot. Francie did not know this. She thought it part of the mystery of his race that he could iron with an iron never heated on a stove. She had a vague theory that the heat came from something he used in place of starch in the shirts and collars. When Francie brought a ticket and a dime back and pushed them across the counter, he gave her the wrapped shirt and 2 lychee nuts in exchange. Francie loved these lychee nuts. There was a crisp, easily broken shell, and the soft, sweet meat inside. Inside the meat was a hard stone that no child had ever been able to break open. It was said that this stone contained a smaller stone, and that the smaller stone contained a smaller stone which contained a yet smaller stone, and so on. It was said that soon the stones got so small you could only see them with a magnifying glass, and those smaller ones got still smaller until you couldn't see them with anything, but they were always there and would never stop coming. It was Francie's first experience with infinity. The best times were when he had to make change. He brought out a small wooden frame strung with thin rods on which were blue, red, yellow, and green balls. He slid the balls up the brass rods, pondered swiftly, clicked them all back into place, and announced, 39 cent. The tiny balls told him how much to charge and how much change to give. Oh, to be a Chinaman, wished Francie, and have such a pretty toy to count on. Oh, to eat all the lychee nuts she wanted, and to know the mystery of the iron that was ever hot and yet never stood on a stove. Oh, to paint those symbols with a slight brush and a quick turn of the wrist, and to make a clear black mark as fragile as a piece of a butterfly wing. That was the mystery of the Orient in Brooklyn. Piano lessons. Magic words. As soon as the Nolans were settled, Katie called on the lady whose card announced piano lessons. There were 2 Miss Tinmores. Miss Lizzie taught piano, and Miss Maggie cultivated the voice. The charge was 25 cents per lesson. Katie proposed a bargain. She'd do 1 hour's cleaning work for the Tinmores in exchange for a lesson each week. Miss Lizzie demurred, claiming her time had more value than Katie's time. Katie argued that time was time. Finally, she got Miss Lizzie to agree that time was time, and arrangements were made. The history-making day of the first lesson arrived. Francie and Neely were instructed to sit in the front room during the lesson and to keep their eyes and ears open. A chair was placed for the teacher. The children sat side by side on the other side of the piano. Katie nervously adjusted and readjusted the seat, and the 3 sat waiting. Miss Tinmore arrived on the dot of 5. Although she only came from downstairs, she was formally attired in street clothes. A taut spotted veil was stretched over her face. Her hat was the breast and wing of a red bird tormentingly pierced by 2 hatpins. Francie stared at the cruel hat. Mama took her into the bedroom and whispered that the bird wasn't a bird at all, just some feathers glued together, and that she mustn't stare. She believed Mama, yet her eyes kept going back to the tormented effigy. Miss Tinmore brought everything with her but the piano. She had a nickel alarm clock and a battered metronome. The clock said 5 o'clock. She set it for 6 and stood it on the piano. She took the privilege of using up part of the precious hour. She removed her pearl-gray skin-tight kid gloves, blew into each finger, smoothed and folded them, and placed them on the piano. She undid her veil and threw it back over her hat. She limbered up her fingers, glanced at the clock, was satisfied she had taken enough minutes, started the metronome, took her seat, and the lesson began. Francie was so fascinated by the metronome that she found it hard to listen to what Miss Tinmore said and to watch the way she placed Mama's hands on the keys. She weaved dreams in time to the soothing, monotonous clicking. As for Neely, his round blue eyes rolled back and forth, following the little swinging rod, until he hypnotized himself into unconsciousness. His mouth relaxed, and his blonde head rolled over on his shoulder. A little bubble came and went as he breathed moistly. Katie dared not wake him lest Miss Tinmore catch on that she was teaching three for the price of one. The metronome clicked on dreamily. The clock ticked querulously. Miss Tinmore, as if not trusting the metronome, counted 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Katie's work-swollen fingers struggled doggedly with her first scale. Time passed, and it grew dark in the room. Suddenly the alarm clock rang out shatteringly. Francie's heart jumped, and Neely fell off his chair. The first lesson was ended. Katie's words tumbled over each other in gratitude. "Even if I never take another lesson, I could go on with what you taught me today. You were a good teacher." Miss Tinmore, while pleased by the flattery, nevertheless told Katie what was what. "I won't charge extra for the children. I just want you to know you're not fooling me." Katie blushed, and the children looked down on the floor, ashamed of being found out. "I will permit the children to stay in the room." Katie thanked her. Miss Tinmore stood up and waited. Katie verified the time she was to do Miss Tinmore's housework. Still she waited. Katie felt that something was expected of her. Finally, she inquired. "Yes?" Miss Tinmore flushed a shell pink and spoke proudly. "The ladies, where I give lessons. Well, they offer me a cup of tea afterwards." She put her hand to her heart and explained vaguely. "Those stairs." "Would you sooner take coffee?" Katie asked. "We have no tea." "Gladly," Miss Tinmore sat down in relief. Katie rushed out to the kitchen and heated the coffee, which was always standing on the stove. While it was warming, she put a sugar bun and a spoon on a round tin tray. In the meantime, Neely had fallen asleep on the sofa. Miss Tinmore and Francie sat exchanging stares. Finally, Miss Tinmore asked, "What are you thinking about, little girl?"
"Just thinking," Francie said.
"Sometimes I see you sitting on the gutter curb for hours. What do you think of then?"
"Nothing. I just tell myself stories."
Miss Tinmore pointed at her sternly. "Little girl, you'll be a story writer when you grow up." It was a command rather than a statement.
"Yes, ma'am,"
agreed Francie out of politeness. Katie came in with the tray. "This may not be as refined as you're used to," she apologized, "but it's what we have in the house."
"It's very good," stated Miss Tinmore daintily.
Then she concentrated on trying not to wolf it down. To tell the truth, the Tinmores lived on the tea they got from their pupils. A few lessons a day at a quarter a lesson did not make for prosperity. After paying their rent, there was little left to eat on. Most of the ladies served them weak tea and soda crackers. The ladies knew what was polite and would come through with a cup of tea, but they had no intention of supplying a meal and paying a quarter, too. So Miss Tinmore came to look forward to the hour at the Nolans. The coffee was heartening, and there was always a bun or a bologna sandwich to sustain her. After each lesson, Katie taught the children what she had been taught. She made them practice half an hour each day. In time, all three of them learned to play the piano. When Johnny heard that Maggie Tinmore gave voice lessons, he figured that he could do no less than Katie. He offered to repair a broken sash cord in one of the Tinmore windows in exchange for 2 voice lessons for Francie. Johnny, who had never even seen a sash cord in all his life, got a hammer and screwdriver and took the whole window frame out of its case. He looked at the broken rope, and that was as far as he could go. He experimented and got nowhere. His heart was willing, but his skill was nil. In attempting to get the window back in to keep out the cold winter rain that was blowing into the room while he was figuring out about the sash cord, he broke a pane of glass. The deal fell through. The Tinmores had to get a regular window man in to fix it.
Katie had to do 2 washings free for the girls to make up for it, and Francie's voice lessons were abandoned forever. School days were eagerly anticipated by Francie. She wanted all of the things that she thought came with school. She was a lonely child, and she longed for the companionship of other children. She wanted to drink from the school water fountains in the yard. The faucets were inverted, and she thought that soda water came out instead of plain water. She had heard Mama and Papa speak of the schoolroom. She wanted to see the map that pulled down like a shade. Most of all, she wanted school supplies, a notebook and tablet, and a pencil box with a sliding top filled with new pencils, an eraser, a little tin pencil sharpener made in the shape of a cannon, a pen wiper, and a 6-inch softwood yellow ruler. Before school, there had to be vaccination. That was the law. How it was dreaded. When the health authorities tried to explain to the poor and illiterate that vaccination was a giving of the harmless form of smallpox to work up immunity against the deadly form, the parents didn't believe it. All they got out of the explanation was that germs would be put into a healthy child's body. Some foreign-born parents refused to permit their children to be vaccinated. They were not allowed to enter school. Then the law got after them for keeping the children out of school. "A free country?" they asked. "You should live so long. What's free about it?" they reasoned when the law forces you to educate your children and then endangers their lives to get them into school. Weeping mothers brought bawling children to the health center for inoculation. They carried on as though bringing their innocence to the slaughter. The children screamed hysterically at the first sight of the needle, and their mothers waiting in the anteroom threw their shawls over their heads and keened loudly as if wailing for the dead. Francie was 7 and Neely 6. Katie had held Francie back, wishing both children to enter school together so that they could protect each other against the older children. On a dreadful Saturday in August, she stopped in the bedroom to speak to them before she went off to work. She awakened them and gave instructions. "Now when you get up, wash yourselves good, and when it gets to be 11 o'clock, go around the corner to the public health place. Tell them to vaccinate you because you're going to school in September." Francie began to tremble. Neely burst into tears. "You coming with us, Mama?" Francie pleaded. "I've got to go to work. Who's going to do my work if I don't?" asked Katie, covering up her conscience with indignation. Francie said nothing more. Katie knew that she was letting them down, but she couldn't help it. She just couldn't help it. Yes, she should go with them to lend the comfort and authority of her presence, but she knew she couldn't stand the ordeal. Yet, they had to be vaccinated. Her being with them or somewhere else couldn't take that fact away. So why shouldn't one of the 3 be spared? Besides, she said to her conscience, it's a hard and bitter world. They've got to live in it. Let them get hardened young to take care of themselves. "Papa's going with us then," said Francie hopefully. "Papa's at headquarters waiting for a job. He won't be home all day. You're big enough to go alone. Besides, it won't hurt." Neely wailed on a higher key. Katie could hardly stand that. She loved the boy so much. Part of her reason for not going with them was that she couldn't bear to see the boy hurt, not even by a pinprick. Almost she decided to go with them. But no. If she went, she'd lose half a day's work and she'd have to make it up on Sunday morning. Besides, she'd be sick afterwards. They'd manage somehow without her. She hurried off to her work. Francie tried to console the terrified Neely. Some older boys had told him that they cut your arm off when they got you in the health center. To take his mind off the thing, Francie took him down into the yard, and they made mud pies. They quite forgot to wash, as Mama had told them to. They almost forgot about 11 o'clock, the mud pie making was so beguiling. Their hands and arms got very dirty playing in the mud. At 10 to 11, Mrs. Gaddis hung out the window and yelled down that their mother had told her to remind them when it was near 11 o'clock. Neely finished off his last mud pie, watering it with his tears. Francie took his hand, and with slow, dragging steps, the children walked around the corner. They took their place on a bench. Next to them sat a Jewish mama, who clutched a large 6-year-old boy in her arms and wept and kissed his forehead passionately from time to time. Other mothers sat there with grim suffering furrowed on their faces. Behind the frosted glass door where the terrifying business was going on, there was a steady bawling punctuated by a shrill scream, resumption of the bawling, and then a pale child would come out with a strip of pure white gauze about his left arm. His mother would rush and grab him, and with a foreign curse and a shaken fist at the frosted door, hurry him out of the torture chamber. Francie went in, trembling. She had never seen a doctor or a nurse in all of her small life. The whiteness of the uniforms, the shiny, cruel instruments laid out on a napkin on a tray, the smell of antiseptics, and especially the cloudy sterilizer with its bloody red cross filled her with tongue-tied fright. The nurse pulled up her sleeve and swabbed a spot clean on her left arm. Francie saw the white doctor coming towards her with the cruelly poised needle. He loomed larger and larger until he seemed to blend into a great needle. She closed her eyes, waiting to die. Nothing happened. She felt nothing. She opened her eyes slowly, hardly daring to hope that it was all over. She found, to her agony, that the doctor was still there, poised needle and all. He was staring at her arm in distaste. Francie looked, too. She saw a small white area on a dirty, dark brown arm. She heard the doctor talking to the nurse. "Filth, filth, filth, from morning to night. I know they're poor, but they could wash. Water is free and soap is cheap. Just look at that arm, nurse." The nurse looked and clucked in horror. Francie stood there with the hot flame points of shame burning her face. The doctor was a Harvard man, interning at the neighborhood hospital. Once a week, he was obligated to put in a few hours at one of the free clinics. He was going into a smart practice in Boston when his internship was over. Adopting the phraseology of the neighborhood, he referred to his Brooklyn internship as going through purgatory when he wrote to his socially prominent fiancée in Boston. The nurse was a Williamsburg girl, you could tell that by her accent. The child of poor Polish immigrants, she had been ambitious, worked days in a sweatshop, and gone to school at night. Somehow she had gotten her training. She hoped someday to marry a doctor. She didn't want anyone to know she had come from the slums. After the doctor's outburst, Francie stood hanging her head. She was a dirty girl. That's what the doctor meant. He was talking more quietly now, asking the nurse how that kind of people could survive. That it would be a better world if they were all sterilized and couldn't breed anymore. Did that mean he wanted her to die? Would he do something to make her die because her hands and arms were dirty from the mud pies? She looked at the nurse. To Francie, all women were mamas like her own mother, and Aunt Sissy and Aunt Evie. She thought that the nurse might say something like, "Maybe this little girl's mother works and didn't have time to wash her good this morning." Or, "You know how it is, doctor. Children will play in dirt." But what the nurse actually said was, "I know. Isn't it terrible? I sympathize with you, doctor. There's no excuse for these people living in filth." A person who pulls himself up from a low environment via the bootstrap route has two choices. Having risen above his environment, he can forget it, or he can rise above it and never forget it, and keep compassion and understanding in his heart for those he has left behind him in the cruel upclimb. The nurse had chosen the forgetting way. Yet, as she stood there, she knew that years later she would be haunted by the sorrow in the face of that starveling child, and that she would wish bitterly that she had said a comforting word then and done something towards the saving of her immortal soul. She had the knowledge that she was small, but she lacked the courage to be otherwise. When the needle jabbed, Francie never felt it. The waves of hurt started by the doctor's words were racking her body and drove out all other feeling. While the nurse was expertly tying a strip of gauze around her arm, and the doctor was putting his instrument in the sterilizer and taking out a fresh needle, Francie spoke up. "My brother is next. His arm is just as dirty as mine, so don't be surprised. And you don't have to tell him. You told me." They stared at this bit of humanity, who had become so strangely articulate. Francie's voice went ragged with a sob. "You don't have to tell him. Besides, it won't do no good. He's a boy, and he don't care if he is dirty." She turned, stumbled a little, and walked out of the room. As the door closed, she heard the doctor's surprised voice. "I had no idea she'd understand what I was saying," she heard the nurse say.
"Oh, well,"
on a sighing note. Katie was home for lunch when the children got back. She looked at their bandaged arms with misery in her eyes. Francie spoke out passionately.
"Why, Mama? Why? Why do they have to say things and then stick a needle in your arm?"
"Vaccination," said Mama firmly, now that it was all over, "is a very good thing. It makes you tell your left hand from your right. You have to write with your right hand when you go to school, and that sore will be there to say, not this hand. Use the other hand." This explanation satisfied Francie because she had never been able to tell her left hand from her right. She ate and drew pictures with her left hand. Katie was always correcting her and transferring the chalk or the needle from her left hand to her right. After Mama explained about vaccination, Francie began to think that maybe it was a wonderful thing. It was a small price to pay if it simplified such a great problem and let you know which hand was which. Francie began using her right hand instead of the left after the vaccination and never had trouble afterwards. Francie worked up a fever that night and the site of the injection itched painfully. She told Mama, who became greatly alarmed. She gave intense instructions. You're not to scratch it, no matter how it bites you.
Why can't I scratch it?
Because if you do, your whole arm will swell up and turn black and drop right off. So don't scratch it. Katie did not mean to terrify the child. She herself was badly frightened. She believed that blood poisoning would set in if the arm were touched. She wanted to frighten the child into not scratching it. Francie had to concentrate on not scratching the painfully itching area. The next day, shots of pain were shooting up the arm. While preparing for bed, she peered under the bandage. To her horror, the place where the needle had entered was swollen, dark green, and festering yellowly. And Francie had not scratched it. She knew she had not scratched it. But wait, maybe she had scratched it in her sleep the night before. Yes, she must have done it then. She was afraid to tell Mama. Mama would say, I told you and I told you and still you wouldn't listen. Now look. It was Sunday night. Papa was out working. She couldn't sleep. She got up from her cot and went into the front room and sat at the window. She leaned her head on her arms and waited to die. At 3 a.m, she heard a Graham Avenue trolley grind to a stop on the corner. That meant someone was getting off. She leaned out the window. Yes, it was Papa. He sauntered down the street with his light dancer's step whistling, My sweetheart's the man in the moon. The figure in its tuxedo and derby hat, with a rolled-up waiter's apron in a neat packet under its arm, seemed like life itself to Francie. She called to him when he got to the door. He looked up and tipped his hat gallantly. She opened the kitchen door for him. "What are you doing up so late, prima donna?" he asked. "It's not Saturday night, you know."
"I was sitting at the window," she whispered, "waiting for my arm to drop off."
He choked back a laugh. She explained about the arm. He closed the door leading into the bedrooms and turned up the gas. He removed the bandage and his stomach turned over at sight of the swollen, festering arm. But he never let her know. He never let her know.
"Why, baby, that's nothing at all. Just nothing at all. You should have seen my arm when I was vaccinated. It was twice as swollen and red, white, and blue instead of green and yellow. And now look how hard and strong it is."
He lied gallantly, for he had never been vaccinated. He poured warm water into a basin and added a few drops of carbolic acid. He washed the ugly sore over and over again. She winced when it stung, but Johnny said that stinging meant curing. He sang a foolish, sentimental song in a whisper as he washed it. He never cares to wander from his own fireside. He never cares to ramble or to roam. He looked around for a clean bit of cloth to serve as a bandage. Finding none, he took off his coat and shirt dickie, pulled his undershirt off, over his head, and dramatically ripped a strip of cloth from it.
"Your good undershirt," she protested.
"It was all full of holes, anyhow." He bandaged the arm. The cloth smelled of Johnny, warm and cigarish, but it was a comforting thing to the child. It smelled of protection and love. "There, you're all fixed up, prima donna. Whatever gave you the idea your arm was going to drop off?"
"Mama said it would if I scratched it. I didn't mean to scratch it, but I guess I did while I was sleeping."
"Maybe." He kissed her thin cheek. "Now go back to bed." She went and slept peacefully the rest of the night. In the morning, the throbbing had stopped, and in a few days the arm was normal again. After Francie had gone to bed, Johnny smoked another cigar. Then he undressed slowly and got into Katie's bed. She was sleepily aware of his presence, and in one of her rare impulses of affection, she threw her arm across his chest. He removed it gently and edged as far away from her as he could. He lay close to the wall. He folded his hands under his head and lay staring into the darkness all the rest of that night. Francie expected great things from school. Since vaccination taught her instantly the difference between left and right, She thought that school would bring forth even greater miracles. She thought she'd come home from school that first day knowing how to read and write. But all she came home with was a bloody nose gained by an older child slamming her head down on the stone rim of the water trough when she had tried to drink from the faucets that did not gush forth soda water after all. Francie was disappointed because she had to share a seat and desk, meant only for one, with another girl. She had wanted a desk to herself. She accepted with pride the pencil the monitor passed out to her in the morning, and reluctantly surrendered it to another monitor at 3 o'clock. She had been in school but half a day when she knew that she would never be a teacher's pet. That privilege was reserved for a small group of girls. Girls with freshly curled hair, crisp, clean pinafores, and new silk hair bows. They were the children of the prosperous storekeepers of the neighborhood. Francie noticed how Miss Briggs, the teacher, beamed on them and seated them in the choicest places in the front row. These darlings were not made to share seats. Miss Briggs's voice was gentle when she spoke to these fortune-favored few, and snarling when she spoke to the great crowd of unwashed. Francie, huddled with other children of her kind, learned more that first day than she realized. She learned the class system of a great democracy. She was puzzled and hurt by teacher's attitude. Obviously, the teacher hated her and others like her for no other reason than that they were what they were. Teacher acted as though they had no right to be in the school, but that she was forced to accept them and was doing so with as little grace as possible. She begrudged them the few crumbs of learning she threw at them. Like the doctor at the health center, she too acted as though they had no right to live. It would seem as if all the unwanted children would stick together and be one against the things that were against them. But not so. They hated each other as much as the teacher hated them. They aped teacher's snarling manner when they spoke to each other. There was always one unfortunate whom the teacher singled out and used for a scapegoat. This poor child was the nagged one, the tormented one, the one on whom she vented her spinsterly spleen. As soon as a child received this dubious recognition, the other children turned on him and duplicated the teacher's torments. Characteristically, they fawned on those close to teacher's heart. Maybe they figured they were nearer to the throne that way. 3,000 children crowded into this ugly, brutalizing school that had facilities for only 1,000. Dirty stories went the rounds of the children. One of them was that Miss Pfeiffer, a bleach-blonde teacher with a high giggle, went down to the basement to sleep with the assistant janitor those times when she put a monitor in charge and explained that she had to step out to the office. Another, passed around by little boys who had been victims, was that the lady principal, a hard-bitten, heavy, cruel woman of middle years, who wore sequin-decorated dresses and smelled always of raw gin, got recalcitrant boys into her office and made them take down their pants so that she could flay their naked buttocks with a rattan cane. She whipped the little girls through their dresses. Of course, corporal punishment was forbidden in the schools, but who outside knew? Who would tell? Not the whipped children, certainly. It was a tradition in the neighborhood that if a child reported that he had been whipped in school, he would receive a second home whipping because he had not behaved in school. So the child took his punishment and kept quiet, leaving well enough alone. The ugliest thing about these stories was that they were all sordidly true. Brutalizing is the only adjective for the public schools of that district around 1908 and 09. Child psychology had not been heard of in Williamsburg in those days. Teaching requirements were easy, graduation from high school and 2 years at teacher's training school. Few teachers had the true vocation for their work. They taught because it was one of the few jobs open to them, because it was better paying than factory work, because they had a long summer vacation, because they got a pension when they retired. They taught because no one wanted to marry them. Married women were not allowed to teach in those days, hence most of the teachers were women made neurotic by starved love instincts. These barren women spent their fury on other women's children in a twisted, authoritative manner. The cruelest teachers were those who had come from homes similar to those of the poor children. It seemed that in their bitterness towards those unfortunate little ones, they were somehow exercising their own fearful background. Of course, not all of the teachers were bad. Sometimes one who was sweet came along, one who suffered with the children, and tried to help them. But these women did not last long as teachers. Either they married quickly and left the profession, or they were hounded out of their jobs by fellow teachers. The problem of what was delicately called leaving the room was a grim one. The children were instructed to go before they left home in the morning, and then to wait until lunch hour. There was supposed to be a time at recess, but few children were able to take advantage of that. Usually the press of the crowd prevented a child's getting near the washrooms. If he was lucky enough to get there, where there were but 10 lavatories for 500 children, he'd find the places preempted by the 10 most brutalized children in the school. They'd stand in the doorways and prevent entrance to all comers. They were deaf to the piteous pleas of the hordes of tormented children who swarmed before them. A few exacted a fee of a penny which few children were able to pay. The overlords never relaxed their hold on the swinging doors until the bell clanged the end of recess. No one ever ascertained what pleasure they derived from this macabre game. They were never punished, since no teacher ever entered the children's washrooms. No child ever snitched. No matter how young he was, he knew that he mustn't squeal. If he tattled, he knew he would be tortured almost to death by the one he reported. So this evil game went on and on. Technically, a child was permitted to leave the room if he asked permission. There was a system of coy evasion. One finger held aloft meant that a child wished to go out but a short time. Two fingers meant desire for a longer stay. But the harassed and unfeeling teachers assured each other that this was just a subterfuge for a child to get out of the classroom for a little while. They knew the child had ample opportunity at recess and at lunchtime. Thus they settled things among themselves. Of course, Francie noted, the favored children, the clean, the dainty, the cared for in the front seats, were allowed to leave at any time. But that was different somehow. As for the rest of the children, half of them learned to adjust their functions to the teacher's ideas of such things, and the other half became chronic pants-wetters. It was Aunt Sissy who fixed up the leaving-the-room business for Francie. She had not seen the children since Katie and Johnny had told her she was not to visit the house again. She was lonesome for them. She knew they had started school, and she just had to know how they were getting along. It was in November. Work was slack and Sissy was laid off. She sauntered down the school street just as school was letting out. If the children reported meeting her, it would seem like an accident, she figured. She saw Neely first in the crowd. A bigger boy snatched his cap off, trampled on it, and ran away. Neely turned to a smaller boy and did the same to his cap. Sissy grabbed Neely's arm, but with a raucous cry, he twisted loose and ran down the street. With poignancy, Sissy realized that he was growing up. Francie saw Sissy and put her arms around her right there on the street and kissed her. Sissy took her into a little candy store and treated her to a penny chocolate soda. Then she made Francie sit down on a stoop and tell her all about school. Francie showed her the primer and her homework book with block letters in it. Sissy was impressed. She looked long into the child's thin face and noticed that she was shivering. She saw that she was inadequately dressed against the raw November day, in a threadbare cotton dress, ragged little sweater, and thin cotton stockings. She put her arm around her and held her close to her own life warmth. "Francie, baby, you're trembling like a leaf." Francie had never heard that expression, and it made her thoughtful. She looked at the little tree growing out of the concrete at the side of the house. There were still a few dried leaves clinging to it. One of them rustled dryly in the wind. "Trembling like a leaf." She stored the phrase away in her mind. "Trembling. What's the matter?" Sissy asked. "Your ice cold." Francie wouldn't tell at first, but after being coaxed, she buried her shame-hot face in Sissy's neck and whispered something to her. "Oh, my," said Sissy. "No wonder you're cold. Why didn't you ask to? Teacher never looks at us when we raise our hands." "Oh, well, don't worry about it. It could happen to anyone. It happened to the Queen of England when she was a little girl." But had the Queen been so shamed and sensitive about it? Francie wept quietly and rackingly, tears of shame and fear. She was afraid to go home, afraid that Mama would make scornful shame of her. "Your Mama won't scold you. Such an accident could happen to any little girl. Don't say I told you, but your Mama wet her pants when she was little, and your Grandma did too. It's nothing new in the world, and you're not the first one it happened to." "But I'm too big. Only babies do that. Mama'll make shame on me in front of Neely." "Tell her right out before she finds out for herself, and promise never to do it again. She won't shame you then." "I can't promise, because it might happen again, because teacher don't let us go." "From now on, your teacher will let you leave the room any time you have to. You believe Aunt Sissy, don't you?"
"Yes. But how do you know?"
I'll burn a candle in church about it. Francie was consoled with the promise. When Francie went home, Katie did a little routine scolding, but Francie was armored against it in the light of what Sissy had told her about the cycle of wedding. The next morning, 10 minutes before school started, Sissy was in that classroom confronting the teacher. "There's a little girl named Francie Nolan in your room," she started out. "Frances Nolan," corrected Miss Briggs. "Is she smart?"
"Yes."
"Is she good?"
"She had better be."
Sissy brought her face closer to Miss Briggs. Her voice went a tone lower and was gentler than before, but for some reason Miss Briggs backed away. "I just asked you, is she a good girl?"
"Yes, she is," said teacher hurriedly.
"I happen to be her mother," lied Sissy.
"No."
"Yes." "Anything you want to know about the child's work, Mrs. Nolan?"
"Did it ever occur to you," lied Sissy, "that Francie's got kidney trouble?"
"Kidney what?" "The doctor said that if she wants to go and some people don't let her go, she's liable to drop right down dead from overloaded kidneys."
"Surely you're exaggerating. How would you like her to drop dead in this room?"
"Naturally, I wouldn't, but..." "And how would you like to get a ride to the station house in the pie wagon and stand up in front of this here doctor and the judge and say you wouldn't let her leave the room?"
Was Sissy lying?
Miss Briggs couldn't tell. It was the most fantastic thing. Yet the woman spoke these sensational things in the calmest, softest voice she had ever heard. At this moment, Sissy happened to look out of the window and saw a burly cop sauntering by. She pointed.
"See that cop?"
Miss Briggs nodded.
"That's my husband."
"Francis's father?"
"Who else?"
Sissy threw open the window and yelled.
"Yoo-hoo! Johnny!"
The astonished cop looked up. She blew him a great kiss. For a split second, he thought it was some love-starved old maid teacher gone crazy. Then his native masculine conceit assured him that it was one of the younger teachers who had long had a crush on him and had finally screwed up enough courage to make a passionate overture. He responded to the occasion, blew her a return kiss with a hammy fist, tipped his hat gallantly, and sauntered off down his beat whistling, "At the Devil's Ball."
"Sure, I'm a divil amongst the ladies," he thought. "I am that, and me with 6 kids at home."
Miss Briggs's eyes bugged out in astonishment. He had been a handsome cop, and strong. Just then, one of the little golden girls came in with a ribbon box of candy for teacher. Miss Briggs gurgled with pleasure and kissed the child's satin pink cheek. Sissy had a mind like a freshly honed razor. In a flash, she saw which way the wind blew. She saw it blew against children like Francie. "Look," she said, "I guess you don't think we got lots of money."
"I'm sure I never. We're not people that put on."
"Now Christmas is coming," she bribed.
"Maybe," conceded Miss Briggs. "I haven't always seen Frances when she raised her hand."
"Where does she sit that you don't see her so good?" Teacher indicated a dark back seat.
"Maybe if she sat up front more, you could see her better.
The seating arrangements are all set."
"Christmas is coming," warned Sissy coyly.
"I'll see what I can do."
"See then,
and see that you see good." Sissy walked to the door, then turned.
"Because not only is Christmas coming, but my husband, who is a cop, will come up here and beat hell out of you if you don't treat her right."
Francie had no more trouble after that parent-teacher conference. No matter how timorously her hand went up, Miss Briggs happened to see it. She even let her sit in the first row, first seat, for a while. But when Christmas came and no expensive Christmas present came with it, Francie was again relegated to the dark back of the room. Neither Francie nor Katie ever learned of Sissy's school visit. But Francie was never shamed again in that way, and if Miss Briggs did not treat her with kindness, at least she didn't nag at her. Of course, Miss Briggs knew that what that woman had told her was ridiculous. Yet what was the use of taking chances? She didn't like children, but she was no fiend. She wouldn't want to see a child drop dead before her eyes. A few weeks later, Sissy had one of the girls in her shop write a postcard message for her to Katie. She asked her sister to let bygones be bygones and permit her to come to the house at least to see the children once in a while. Katie ignored the card. Mary Romilly came over to intercede for Sissy.
"What is there that is bitter between you and your sister?"
she asked Katie. I cannot tell you, replied Katie.
Forgiveness, said Mary Romilly, is a gift of high value, yet its cost is nothing.
I have my own ways, said Katie.
Aye,
agreed her mother. She sighed deeply and said no more. Katie wouldn't admit it, but she missed Sissy. She missed her reckless good sense and her clear way of straightening out troubles. Evie never mentioned Sissy when she came to see Katie, and after that one attempt at reconciliation, Mary Romilly never mentioned Sissy's name again. Katie got news of her sister through the official accredited family reporter, the insurance agent. All of the Romillys were insured by the same company, and the same agent collected the nickels and dimes from each of the sisters weekly. He brought news, carried gossip, and was the round-robin messenger of the family. One day he brought news that Sissy had given birth to another child, which he had been unable to insure since it had lived but 2 hours. Katie felt ashamed of herself at last for being so bitter against poor Sissy. "Next time you see my sister," she told the collector, "tell her not to be such a stranger." The collector relayed the message of forgiveness, and Sissy came back into the Nolan family again. Katie's campaign against vermin and disease started the day her children entered school. The battle was fierce, brief, and successful. Packed closely together, the children innocently bred vermin and became lousy from each other. Through no fault of their own, they were subjected to the most humiliating procedure that a child could go through. Once a week, the school nurse came and stationed herself with her back to the window. The little girls lined up, and when they came to her, turned round, lifted their heavy braids, and bent over. Nurse probed about the hair with a long, thin stick. If lice or nits were in evidence, the little one was told to stand aside. At the end of the examination, the pariahs were made to stand before the class, while nurse gave a lecture about how filthy those little girls were and how they had to be shunned. The untouchables were then dismissed for the day, with instructions to get blue ointment from Knipe's drugstore and have their mothers treat their head. When they returned to school, they were tormented by their peers. Each offender would have an escort of children following her home, chanting, "Lousy, you're lousy, teacher said, you're lousy. Had to go home, had to go home, had to go home because you're lousy." It might be that the infected child would be given a clean bill next examination. In that case, she in turn would torment those found guilty, forgetting her own hurt at being tormented. They learned no compassion from their own anguish. Thus their suffering was wasted. There was no room in Katie's crowded life for additional trouble and worry. She wouldn't accept it. The first day that Francie came home from school and reported that she sat next to a girl who had bugs walking up and down the lanes of her hair, Katie went into action. She scrubbed Francie's head with a cake of her coarse, strong, yellow scrubwoman's soap until her scalp tingled with rawness. The next morning she dipped the hairbrush into a bowl of kerosene oil, brushed Francie's hair vigorously, braided it into braids so tight that the veins on Francie's temple stuck out, instructed her to keep away from lighted gas jets, and sent her off to school. Francie smelled up the whole classroom, her seat chair edged as far away from her as possible. Teacher sent a note home forbidding Katie to use kerosene on Francie's head. Katie remarked that it was a free country and ignored the note. Once a week she scrubbed Francie's head with the yellow soap. Every day she anointed it with the kerosene. When an epidemic of mumps broke out in the school, Katie went into action against communicable diseases. She made 2 flannel bags, sewed a bud of garlic in each one, attached a clean corset string, and made the children wear them around their necks under their shirts. Francie attended school stinking of garlic and kerosene oil. Everyone avoided her. In the crowded yard there was always a cleared space around her. In crowded trolley cars, people huddled away from those Nolan children. And it worked. Now, whether there was a witch's charm in the garlic, whether the strong fumes killed the germs, or whether Francie escaped contracting anything because infected children gave her a wide berth, or whether she and Neely had naturally strong constitutions, is not known. However, it was a fact that not once in all the years of school were Katie's children ever sick. They never so much as came down with a cold, and they never had lice. Francie, of course, became an outsider shunned by all because of her stench. But she had become accustomed to being lonely. She was used to walking alone, and to being considered different. She did not suffer too much. Francie liked school in spite of all the meanness, cruelty, and unhappiness. The regimented routine of many children, all doing the same thing at once, gave her a feeling of safety. She felt that she was a definite part of something, part of a community gathered under a leader for the one purpose. The Nolans were individualists. They conformed to nothing except what was essential to their being able to live in their world. They followed their own standards of living. They were part of no set social group. This was fine for the making of individualists, but sometimes bewildering to a small child. So Francie felt a certain safety and security in school. Although it was a cruel and ugly routine, it had a purpose and a progression. School was not all unrelieved grimness. There was a great golden glory lasting a half hour each week when Mr. Morton came to Francie's room to teach music. He was a specialized teacher who went around to all the schools in that area. It was holiday time when he appeared. He wore a swallow-tailed coat and a puffed-up tie. He was so vibrant, gay, and jolly, so intoxicated with living, that he was like a god come from the clouds. He was homely in a gallant, vital way. He understood and loved children, and they worshipped him. The teachers adored him. There was a carnival spirit in the room on the day of his visit. Teacher wore her best dress and wasn't quite so mean. Sometimes she curled her hair and wore perfume. That's what Mr. Morton did to those ladies. He arrived like a tornado. The door burst open and he flew in with his coattail streaming behind him. He leaped to the platform and looked around smiling and saying, "Well, well," in a happy voice. The children sat there and laughed out of happiness, and teacher smiled and smiled. He drew notes on the blackboard. He drew little legs on them to make them look as though they were running out of the scale. He'd make a flat note look like Humpty Dumpty. A sharp note would rate a thin, beet-like nose zooming off it. All the while he'd burst into singing just as spontaneously as a bird. Sometimes his happiness was so overflowing that he couldn't hold it, and he'd cut a dance caper to spill some of it out. He taught them good music without letting them know it was good. He set his own words to the great classics and gave them simple names like lullaby and serenade and street song and song for a sunshine day. Their baby voices shrilled out in Handel's Largo, and they knew it merely by the title of hymn. Little boys whistled part of Dvorak's New World Symphony as they played marbles. When asked the name of the song, they'd reply, "Oh, going home." They played Patsy, humming the soldier's chorus from Faust, which they called Glory. Not as well loved as Mr. Morton, but as much admired, was Miss Bernstone, the special drawing teacher who also came once a week. Ah, she was from another world, a world of beautiful dresses of muted greens and garnets. Her face was sweet and tender, and like Mr. Morton, she loved the vast hordes of unwashed and unwanted children more than she loved the cared-for ones. The teachers did not like her. Yes, they fawned on her when she spoke to them, and glowered at her when her back was turned. They were jealous of her charm, her sweetness, and her lovely appeal to men. She was warm and glowing and richly feminine. They knew that she didn't sleep alone nights, as they were forced to do. She spoke softly in a clear singing voice. Her hands were beautiful and quick with a bit of chalk or a stick of charcoal. There was magic in the way her wrist turned when she held a crayon. One wrist twist and there was an apple. Two more twists and there was a child's sweet hand holding the apple. On a rainy day, she wouldn't give a lesson. She'd take a block of paper and a stick of charcoal and sketch the poorest, meanest kid in the room. And when the picture was finished, you didn't see the dirt or the meanness. You saw the glory of innocence and the poignancy of a baby growing up too soon. Oh, Miss Bernstone was grand. These two visiting teachers were the gold and silver sunsplash in the great muddy river of school days. Days made up of dreary hours in which teacher made her pupils sit rigid with their hands folded behind their back while she read a novel hidden in her lap. If all the teachers had been like Miss Bernstone and Mr. Morton, Francie would have known plain what heaven was. But it was just as well. There had to be the dark and muddy waters so that the sun could have something to background its flashing glory. Oh, magic hour, when a child first knows it can read printed words. For quite a while, Francie had been spelling out letters, sounding them, and then putting the sounds together to mean a word. But one day, she looked at a page, and the word mouse had instantaneous meaning. She looked at the word, and the picture of a gray mouse scampered through her mind. She looked further, and when she saw Horse, she heard him pawing the ground and saw the sun glint on his glossy coat. The word running hit her suddenly, and she breathed hard as though running herself. The barrier between the individual sound of each letter and the whole meaning of the word was removed, and the printed word meant a thing at one quick glance. She read a few pages rapidly and almost became ill with excitement. She wanted to shout it out. She could read. She could read. From that time on, the world was hers for the reading. She would never be lonely again, never miss the lack of intimate friends. Books became her friends, and there was one for every mood. There was poetry for quiet companionship. There was adventure when she tired of quiet hours. There would be love stories when she came into adolescence, and when she wanted to feel a closeness to someone, she could read a biography. On that day, when she first knew she could read, she made a vow to read one book a day as long as she lived. She liked numbers and sums. She devised a game in which each number was a family member, and the answer made a family grouping with a story to it. Naught was a babe in arms. He gave no trouble. Whenever he appeared, you just carried him. The figure one was a pretty baby girl just learning to walk, and easy to handle. Two was a baby boy who could walk and talk a little. He went into family life, into sums, etc., with very little trouble. And three was an older boy in kindergarten who had to be watched a little. Then there was four, a girl of Francie's age. She was almost as easy to mind as two. The mother was five, gentle and kind. In large sums, she came along and made everything easy the way a mother should. The father, six, was harder than the others, but very just. But seven was mean. He was a crotchety old grandfather and not at all accountable for how he came out. The grandmother, eight, was hard, too, but easier to understand than seven. Hardest of all was nine. He was company, and what a hard time fitting him into family life. When Francie added a sum, she would fix a little story to go with the result. If the answer was 924, it meant that the little boy and girl were being minded by company while the rest of the family went out. When a number such as 1,024 appeared, it meant that all the little children were playing together in the yard. The number 62 meant that Papa was taking the little boy for a walk. 50 meant that Mama had the baby out in the buggy for an airing. And 78 meant Grandfather and Grandmother sitting home by the fire of a winter's evening. Each single combination of numbers was a new setup for the family, and no two stories were ever the same. Francie took the game with her up into algebra. X was the boy's sweetheart who came into the family life and complicated it. Y was the boyfriend who caused trouble. So arithmetic was a warm and human thing to Francie and occupied many lonely hours of her time. School days went along. Some were made up of meanness, brutality, and heartbreak. Others were bright and beautiful because of Miss Burnstone and Mr. Morton. And always there was the magic of learning things. Francie was out walking one Saturday in October, and she chanced on an unfamiliar neighborhood. Here were no tenements or raucous shabby stores. There were old houses that had been standing there when Washington maneuvered his troops across Long Island. They were old and decrepit, but there were picket fences around them with gates on which Francie longed to swing. There were bright fall flowers in the front yard, and maple trees with crimson and yellow leaves on the curb. The neighborhood stood old, quiet, and serene in this Saturday sunshine. There was a brooding quality about the neighborhood, a quiet, deep, timeless, shabby peace. Francie was as happy as though, like Alice, she had stepped through a magic mirror. She was in an enchanted land. She walked on further and came to a little old school. Its old bricks glowed garnet in the late afternoon sun. There was no fence around the schoolyard, and the school grounds were grass and not cement. Across from the school, it was practically open country, a meadow with goldenrod, wild asters, and clover growing in it. Francie's heart turned over. This was it. This was the school she wanted to go to. But how could she get to go there? There was a strict law about attending the school in your own district. Her parents would have to move to that neighborhood if she wanted to go to that school. Francie knew that Mama wouldn't move just because she felt like going to another school. She walked home slowly, thinking about it. She sat up that night, waiting for Papa to come home from work. After Johnny had come home whistling his Molly Malone as he ran up the steps, After all had eaten of the lobster, caviar, and liverwurst that he brought home, Mama and Neely went to bed. Francie kept Papa company while he smoked his last cigar. Francie whispered all about the school in Papa's ear. He looked at her, nodded, and said, "We'll see tomorrow."
"You mean we can move near that school?"
"No, but there has to be another way. I'll go there with you tomorrow and we'll see what we can see." Francie was so excited she couldn't sleep the rest of the night. She was up at 7, but Johnny was still sleeping soundly. She waited in a perspiration of impatience. Each time he sighed in his sleep, she ran in to see if he was waking up. He woke about noon, and the Nolans sat down to dinner. Francie couldn't eat. She kept looking at Papa, but he made her no sign. Had he forgotten? Had he forgotten? No, because while Katie was pouring the coffee, he said carelessly,
"I guess me and the prima donna will take a little walk later on."
Francie's heart jumped. He had not forgotten. He had not forgotten. She waited. Mama had to answer. Mama might object. Mama might ask why. Mama might say she guessed she'd go along too. But all Mama said was, "All right." Francie did the dishes. Then she had to go down to the candy store to get the Sunday paper. Then to the cigar store to get Papa a nickel Corona. Johnny had to read the paper. He had to read every column of it, including the society section in which he couldn't possibly be interested. Worse than that, he had to make comments to Mama on every item he read. Each time he put the paper aside, turned to Mama and say, "Funny things in the papers nowadays. Take this case." Francie would almost cry. 4 o'clock came. The cigar had long since been smoked. The paper lay gutted on the floor. Katie had tired of having the news analyzed and had taken Neely and gone over to visit Mary Romilly. Francie and Papa set out hand in hand. He was wearing his only suit, the tuxedo, and his derby hat, and he looked very grand. It was a splendid October day. There was a warm sun and a refreshing wind working together to bring the tang of the ocean around each corner. They walked a few blocks, turned a corner, and were in this other neighborhood. Only in a great sprawling place like Brooklyn could there be such a sharp division. It was a neighborhood peopled by fifth and sixth generation Americans, whereas in the Nolan neighborhood, if you could prove you had been born in America, it was equivalent to a Mayflower standing. Indeed, Francie was the only one in her classroom whose parents were American-born. At the beginning of the term, teacher called the roll and asked each child her lineage. The answers were typical.
"I'm Polish-American. My father was born in Warsaw."
"Irish-American. Me father and mither were born in County Cork."
When Nolan was called, Francie answered proudly,
"I'm an American."
"I know you're American," said the easily exasperated teacher.
"But what's your nationality?"
"American," insisted Francie even more proudly.
"Will you tell me what your parents are, or do I have to send you to the principal?"
"My parents are American. They were born in Brooklyn."
All the children turned around to look at a little girl whose parents had not come from the old country. And when teacher said,
"Brooklyn? I guess that makes you American, all right."
Francie was proud and happy. How wonderful was Brooklyn, she thought, when just being born there automatically made you an American. Papa told her about this strange neighborhood, how its families had been Americans for more than 100 years back, how they were mostly Scotch, English, and Welsh extraction. The men worked as cabinet makers and fine carpenters. They worked with metals, gold, silver, and copper. He promised to take Francie to the Spanish section of Brooklyn some day. There the men worked as cigar makers and each chipped in a few pennies a day to hire a man to read to them while they worked. And the man read fine literature. They walked along the quiet Sunday street. Francie saw a leaf flutter from a tree, and she skipped ahead to get it. It was a clear scarlet with an edging of gold. She stared at it, wondering if she'd ever see anything as beautiful again. A woman came from around the corner. She was rouged heavily and wore a feather boa. She smiled at Johnny and said,
"Lonesome, mister?"
Johnny looked at her a moment before he answered gently,
"No, sister."
"Sure?"
she inquired archly.
"Sure," he answered quietly.
She went her way. Francie skipped back and took Papa's hand.
"Was that a bad lady, Papa?"
she asked eagerly.
"No."
"But she looked bad."
"There are very few bad people.
There are just a lot of people that are unlucky.
But she was all painted in.
She was one who had seen better days. He liked the phrase. Yes, she may have seen better days.